This podcast is brought to you by Julius Meinl Coffee. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR Football Nation Radio.
Hello, I'm your host, Louise Taffer, with Josh Parrish. It's great to have your company this evening. And happy UEFA Champions League second leg eve. Bit of a mouthful.
Yeah, it's a couple of very enticing ties coming up this week.
I am so excited.
The question is, which one do you watch tomorrow morning? They're simultaneous kickoffs.
Oh, you have multi-view. You have one on your TV and the other on your laptop.
Can you actually concentrate that hard on both games at one time? I mean, I'm not Rick Dondrea here. I can't just take in multiple screens at once.
I know. It's hard, isn't it? You've got to be engaged in one, but you want to watch the other. Look, I'm not sure because both are thrilling encounters, all to play for. I'm really looking forward to it. Maybe just have to toss between the two.
Absolutely. And I think Ajax is probably my pick. I mean, I do follow United sort of casually, but you're a much bigger United fan than I am. But I think Ajax is just such an exciting team to watch. The youngsters that they have at their disposal are coming up against such a storied powerhouse of European football with Cristiano Ronaldo, no less. I give them a pretty good chance.
Oh, it's incredible to see what Ajax as a club are doing and have done throughout their history by bringing a lot of the young players through to the first team and really giving them an opportunity, because now we're seeing that those young players who are only 19, 20 are moving on to Barcelona and some of these big, much experience, and, you know, they are just so talented.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been really impressed, especially by a couple of the guys who are or may be departing for Barcelona.
Which one, I'll tell
season.
You.
Frenkie de Jong is confirmed.
That's confirmed.
But Matthias de Ligt has, especially in recent days, been heavily linked with Barcelona as well. And I think he would slot very, very nicely as maybe a long-term successor to Gerard Piqué in that back line.
Yeah, exactly my thoughts. And we heard de Ligt say that it's his dream to go to Barcelona. And I think that Ajax and Barcelona play a very similar brand of football and they have similar core values.
They're culturally linked, of course. I mean, there's a reason that Ajax play out of the Johan Cruyff Arena, and he is the father of basically Barcelona's modern style of football, came from the Dutch. So,
and he set up La Masia at Barcelona.
He did indeed. I think maybe Barcelona have become a little bit more pragmatic in recent seasons since Pep Guardiola left the club. And, you know, under the current manager, maybe they play a little bit more counter-attacking football. They're not always as free-flowing as you might like, but they've found a way to get the best out of Messi so he doesn't have to run too much and he can conserve his energy, and they're devastatingly effective in what they do. And they can put together sequences of play in sort of 5 or 10 minute periods that are just unbelievable with the amount of talent they've got in their squad.
So they make it look so effortless.
I can't really see Manchester United going through tomorrow, unfortunately.
Okay. You don't think that David De Gea might be Manchester United's saving grace?
Well, he can save all the shots he wants, but they're 1-0 down on aggregate and they're going to have to score a couple of goals because I can't see them keeping a clean sheet at Camp Nou. And maybe you can argue they get a 1-0 and take it all the way to penalty kicks, but I don't see that happening. I think Barcelona, they've lost a lot of, you know, away first legs and come back, and now they've got an advantage. So they're just a different team when they're playing at home, and I think they'd be too good for Manchester United, who have really dropped off really ever since Solskjaer was given the permanent managerial role. And they've looked very lucky in some of the games that they've won and dropped some games as well that, you know, they definitely didn't play that well in. And they're just not generating the amount of chances that they were during the early days of his regime.
I think you're right. I think in the past couple of rounds they've kind of dropped off. Whether or not, I mean, it's only a one-goal lead that Barcelona have at the moment. So, in a sense, it is all to play for still. Anything can happen. And we can't forget that there was that infamous triumph over Bayern Munich back in, 1999, where Ole Gunnar Solskjaer scored the stoppage time winner at Camp Nou. How much does that play into the fact that he is now manager and he is leading this young squad to potentially another victory in the UEFA Champions League?
I think it plays some part because, you know, he's been there and done that before, but he's tend to lean on the emotional connection that he has to Manchester United's glory days as a means of sort of currency with the fans. And I think that's getting a little bit tired at this point. I think he is going on and on about, you know, I think he made another joke about last minute winners at the new camp or whatever in the pre-match press conference. And there's only so much, you know, appealing to nostalgia that you can do to, I think he's, it has to show his managerial credentials and not just keep leaning on his relationship with Alex Ferguson and all the legends and so forth to just press the United fans buttons. You can't con people for that long. And eventually he's going to have to come up with some concrete demonstrations of how he is tactically as a coach, because I'm yet to be convinced by him. And if you look at the statistics and the expected goals in the early part of when he was brought in as interim coach, United way outperformed their expected goals. They created far less chances than, you know, they scored goals at an efficiency rate that's just unsustainable. And it's not surprising to see, once he's been appointed permanently, that new manager bounce sort of dips. And it's not surprising to see that come back down to a more kind of average level. And it's plateaued. And I think he needs to find a second win now.
He does. Manchester United will be aiming to overturn a 1-0 deficit and reach the last four of the UEFA Champions League when they play their second leg of the quarterfinal against Barcelona tomorrow morning. It'll be very exciting to watch this game. We know that Lionel Messi has been given the all clear and the Argentinian is fully fit, which is always a dangerous thing.
Yeah, he is obviously one of, if not the best player in the world. I think he's the best player in the world. And even if he only does it in certain moments throughout games rather than dominating the whole affair like maybe he once did, I think his body's slowing down ever so slightly. I think he's got even smarter over the course of his career, and he's able to be efficient in ways that he wasn't in the past with his movement, with his decision-making. He's at a different level these days in front of goal in terms of turning those openings that he creates into goals. And he's just unbelievable to watch when he's in full flight. You see that match against Lyon in the previous round at home, and he decided at one point, he's turning it on, he's going to go win this thing. And once he flicks the switch, it's pretty difficult to stop him. I don't see United, with the amount of injuries they have and the kind of makeshift back line that they have in their team at the moment, being able to deal with him.
I wonder if he can flick the switch tomorrow, though, because there's an interesting stat, Josh.
Mm-hmm.
The 31-year-old has not scored at this stage of the competition since 2013, a streak that has spanned 12 quarterfinal appearances.
And there's been something with Barcelona. I don't think it's Messi's fault, just like I don't think Argentina's failings are Messi's fault. But he hasn't been able to produce in this competition for a few years now, and I think that's something that rankles. You know, ever since their 2015 win, they haven't got anywhere near, whereas Madrid are three-time reigning champions, obviously not this year. So there's been a bit of talk in Spain that Barcelona, at least in Europe, have been wasting some of Messi's best years. And you look at them statistically, especially domestic performances in La Liga, and he's been off the charts. So I don't think it's Messi's fault. I think it's more of a team failing at this stage of the competition. And European football and knockout football is more random than the domestic competition. I think Barcelona has probably been a more complete team than Madrid over the past few seasons, but Madrid have been able to perform in big games and get it done, you know, where it counts, and they live for the European Cup, and Barcelona have to find an answer to that.
I wonder if it will be tomorrow. You're saying yes, they will get it done at home. Manchester United, in that case, will fall out of the competition. Going to the other game, Ajax playing Juventus. And this game is really all to play for, because we saw the 22-year-old Brazilian from Ajax, David Neres, cancel out Cristiano Ronaldo's goal in the first leg, which was just incredible, because they came back from the break and 30 seconds into the second half, he produced this stunning goal, which is just, you know, incredible for Ajax, who could potentially go on.
They could, and I think they probably deserve to get more out of that game at home. Juventus pinched an away goal through Ronaldo. It was a great move. Bentancur stepping through pressure in midfield. Ronaldo continuing his run and wasn't tracked, and it was a trademark kind of header. So he can always produce those moments, and that might be crucial tomorrow. But having said that, Ajax's young side completely dominated possession and chances at home, and you saw them dominate at the Bernabeu. This Juventus team is a lot better than the Real Madrid team they put to the sword, with Tadic completely running the show in a new false nine role, and you know all those creative players they have in the midfield and forward line. But I still think they can do it. It's a question mentally now. I think they have the talent to beat Juventus, or you know, to score goals and go through, maybe even on away goals if it's a draw. But it's all a question of whether they have it in them mentally to go away to one of the toughest stadiums to play at in Turin against this team who've been domestically just ripping Italy apart essentially over the last few years, and now have Cristiano Ronaldo, the big game performer, to back it up. I think it's just a question of whether they shirk from that huge stage or whether they rise to it. And if they rise to it, I think they're a more complete, in terms of just football and quality, better side than Juventus, despite the big names in the Bianconeri lineup.
Incredible. Cristiano Ronaldo will return to the fold after being given the weekend off against Spal. Unfortunately, Juventus didn't even win that game to wrap up the Serie A title, incredibly. So Ronaldo returns to the fold as expected, but there is also an injury cloud surrounding one of Ajax's key players, Frankie de Jong. So he is a huge doubt for this game. If he's out of the squad, can Ajax still potentially get it done?
It's going to be tough for them because he's their linchpin at the heart of the base of the midfield. The manager says it was a precaution that he was taken off at the weekend and he will play. So if you take them at his word, then I think they'll be okay. There's an injury cloud as well at Juventus with Mario Mandzukic ruled out definitively. But I think that one might be a blessing in disguise because Max Allegri has shown this unwillingness to use Paulo Dybala. Maybe he's struggled for form, but for me, he's the most creative player in the whole Juventus team, and he's been sitting on the bench. So if he comes in for Mandzukic, I think Juve will probably win this game because Dybala has got the talent to be able to play between the lines and pick passes that you know other players in the Juve lineup don't see. So I think they will win this game purely because Max Allegri will be forced into playing a guy that he hasn't shown enough faith in this season.
Well, the question still arises as to if he will play Dybala or if he will go with Moise Keane, who has actually been in some starring form and scored in every single starting appearance he's had for Juventus.
Moise Keane is a fantastic player, and I think he's got a lot of potential. I wouldn't be starting him in this game, maybe using him off the bench as an impact sub. He's shown a lot of form in Serie A, that's undoubted, and he kind of reminds me a little bit of a Didier Drogba type, who he's just physically so dominant, and he's got great finishing skills in front of goal. I think he's a sort of out-and-out striking option, whereas Paulo Dybala could play more between the lines. I would be moving Ronaldo right up into that number nine role and playing Dybala just off him. And you can probably shift a Matuidi out into a left-wing role to compensate. So I don't think Keane should start, but definitely as a bench option, he's very useful.
And before we move on to the next topic, a quick score prediction. Are you saying... It doesn't have to be score prediction, but which way will this second leg go for Ajax against Juventus?
I'm going to say if Dybala starts this game, then Juventus will win 2-1. But if he doesn't, if Max Allegri doesn't start him, I think they might have trouble. And I might just go for a narrow Ajax progression, maybe a 2-2, or go through on away goals.
Okay. My heart says Ajax, but I'm saying Juventus.
Yeah, I think they've got to be the favourites for this game at home. But this Ajax team, I'm just a huge fan of the way they play their football.
As am I. You're listening to Evenings on FNR with Louise Taffer and Josh Parrish. And Josh, there's another club that I know you're a huge fan of, and that's Wellington Phoenix.
They've played some very, very attractive football this season, and I think they deserve all the plaudits they've got. But unfortunately, they're going to be without a coach for next season, with Mark Redan departing for Pastures and You in possibly the worst-kept secret in Australian football.
And joining us now to discuss it all with us is Jason Pine. Jason, it's great to have you on the show.
Hi, Louise. Hey, Josh. Nice to talk to you guys again.
Jason, could the statement regarding Mark Rudan leaving the club at the end of the season be any better in terms of timing?
Yeah, look, I think the timing could have been better. Yeah, absolutely. I think in hindsight, they should have probably announced this a lot earlier. If they were going to, if they weren't going to wait until the end of the season, then I think they probably should have. I mean, look, here's a comparison. Adelaide United announced that Marco Kurtz was leaving in the middle of March and got it out of the way. And Adelaide United haven't lost a game since, and they're up into fourth, and they're unencumbered now by any speculation around Marco Kurtz. Everybody knows he's going. The speculation around Mark Rudan at Wellington Phoenix has been lingering for quite some time, and it's impossible really to tell whether that's had an impact on results. I mean, they had that great time in March, didn't they, the Phoenix, when they scored those 15 goals in three games. Last couple of games haven't been quite as good in a couple of pretty crucial outings. So, look, I think if they had their time again, the club and Mark Rudan, I think they probably would have announced the news earlier, got it out there, got it dealt with, and moved on towards the last, say, four or five games of the regular season and the finals. Fact is, it's out now. There are two games to go. The Phoenix still with a chance of obviously they're in the six of gaining that fourth spot in the home final that comes with it. But a long-winded way to answer your question, Luigi. I think it probably could have been done differently.
Piney, what's been the reaction over in New Zealand to this news? I think there's a bit of fan anger, a bit of a split opinion as to, you know, whether Rudan should be thanked for his time or whether he's taken the club along for a ride.
Yeah, it's such an interesting question, Josh. I've been battling away on social media all day, actually, on this very topic. And look, there's one thing I can tell you about Wellington Phoenix fans. They're a passionate lot. They've been through a lot, and I think there's a lot of all the stuff you talked about, and I guess I'll address them one by one. Yes, people do. A lot of fans are angry that he's going, and I think a lot of that is because of what he's done at the club, but also the fact that he is leaving midway through a 2-year contract, and I think a lot of fans were really hoping that he would stay for the 2 years at least, rather than, you know, be one and done. Yes, I think there is a lot to be said for those who say that we should be grateful for what he's done here. I myself fall into that camp. I believe that Mark Rudan has done a wonderful job at Wellington, and if it was only going to be for one season, then I'd rather have one season than no seasons. But I guess sitting in between those two points of view is the other layer of this, and that's where he will go next. And as you said, it seems to be the worst kept secret. You know, all reports are that he will be the new coach of the Western United franchise. I see they're not going to announce that until after the end of the current A-League season, but look, it seems highly likely that that's where Mark Rudan will end up, so automatically fans over here are talking about whether he perhaps has been in the process of recruiting for that new side while he's been in Wellington, if he's talking to some of his current squad about making a move. None of these things, of course, guys, we know to be true or even with any foundation at all. But there is a bit of, a lot of emotions flying around, and they probably range from, you know, from anger through frustration to discontent. But also, I think most people, even those who are really quite angry that Mark Rudan is going, would have to grudgingly at least admit that he's had a really, really positive impact in this A-League season on this team.
And Jason, just on the contract situation, I mean, we've been talking about a 2-year deal this entire time, but I've seen reports just recently, I think from the Soccer Stoppage Time show up in Sydney, that saying that it was actually a 2-year contract, but with a 3-month termination clause that could work both ways. So maybe that's indicative of the state of, you know, Australian coaching contract relations, and that maybe the coaches want a bit more security, but it can actually work both ways, and maybe the club can get caught out.
I think that's right, and it's my understanding, Josh, that the club were the ones who were keen on putting that clause in, and we all know they got burnt by Dadier Kalisic last year. He really decimated the playing group and set the club back quite some distance last year. And so I think maybe the club were just a little bit cautious in recruiting an untried A-League coach. So it's my understanding that they were the ones who put that clause in. And as you say, it's now, in many ways, come back to burn them a little bit, and that it's actually, by the sounds of it, been Mark Rudan who's exercised that clause to exit the club. Having said that, I spoke to David Dome on the radio here in New Zealand yesterday, and he basically said, look, you know, there's no point us trying to keep somebody at the club, a player, a coach, or anybody who doesn't want to be here. And I don't think it's not that Mark Rudan hates it in Wellington. He's become very fond of the place. He has grown emotionally very attached to his players, to the club, to the staff, to the fans. But as we've mentioned many times, you know, and has been talked about many times, he's here without his family. His family are in Australia, and from what I've managed to gather, a move to Wellington was just not something that could be made to happen. And while his family are in Sydney, and there's all the talk about him ending up in Melbourne, as again, my understanding is that a move from Sydney to Melbourne is a lot more palatable than a move from Sydney to Wellington was ever going to be. So, the contract situation, look, it seems to me that in football, if you want to get out of something, you probably can get out of it. And the clause there just made that easier, I guess, for this all to come about.
And Jason, are you privy to how the players are taking this news? And will it affect the team heading into the final series, more importantly?
Yeah, great question, Louise. I'm not privy. No, I haven't. I haven't spoken to any of the players since this news broke. They flew back into Wellington on the weekend after the game against Brisbane. They had a training session today, which didn't have a media element attached to it. So the short answer is no. What you would hope is that actually now it has the opposite effect and now galvanises them. Like I say, the speculation is ended. The rumours can stop being rumours anymore. We now know the scenario that we're in, and that is that Mark Rudan is leaving. So the full focus now can go on to the football because, I mean, what's kind of, I guess, been forgotten in all of this is that the Wellington Phoenix are actually going to play finals football this year. And if you'd offered that to most fans, you know, back in September, they would have bitten your hand off for it. So now there are two games left in the regular season, a big, big clash against Melbourne City and Wellington on Sunday night, then a trip to Perth. And as I say, that fourth spot is still within reach, I guess, depending on what happens in the Adelaide victory game and Adelaide's final game against Brisbane Roar. So, and then the finals beyond that, at least one, possibly two, and who knows, even three games in the finals. So, look, I would hope that actually, with the distraction removed, that the Phoenix can now just narrow their focus, the playing group, to the next three games, possibly four and maybe even five, and just completely narrow their focus into that little time frame of the next month, and let whatever happens beyond that happen. A lot of the players are off contract. You know, some will stay, some won't. The coach is going, a new coach will come in. That's all beyond the middle of May. So I think all the players can do now is just focus on the here and now, and that starts on Sunday night against Melbourne City.
Speaking of the here and now, Piney, what do you put the last two games and the losses down to? It's been a dip in form. I don't know if it's, you know, just par for the course and this is just a random dip, but it seems as if it's coincided with, you know, the ramping up of the speculation about Rudan's future. Do you expect the performances maybe to level out now that the decision's been revealed?
Well, I hope so, Josh, yeah. And you're right, it's hard not to draw that conclusion and make that correlation between the heightening of the speculation and the fact that we understand that the players were told officially that Mark Rudan was leaving sometime. I haven't been able to quite work it out, but it's sometime either just after the Adelaide game or maybe even in around that Adelaide game. I think some of the senior players knew, and then everybody knew by the Brisbane game. So you look at those two performances and particularly the first halves of both games. I mean, if you wanted to rank, you know, the games the Phoenix have played this season, you know, those first halves were probably among the worst they've put out all season. In fact, the first half against Adelaide, I think, was the worst 45 minutes of football I've seen from this team in the 18-19 season. So, look, it's, as I said, hard not to draw some sort of correlation between the two things. What you hope now, though, is that, as I said before, with all this now put to one side, that at a very crucial time of the season, things can turn around because, as you both mentioned at the top of the chat, they've been great to watch Wellington this season. You know, they've defied a lot of people. They've entertained. They've been watchable. They've been a team that have scored goals, and guys like Roy Krishna and David Williams have been in career best form. You know, the emergence of youngsters like Sarpreet Singh, who we talk about a lot, Liberato Kakachi, others coming through now as well. the imports that were brought to the club. Curto and goal, Mandy, Stephen Taylor's been good, Kopchinski. You know, there's been a lot to like about Wellington Phoenix this season. And so what you hope is that the trough is now at an end and we're back on an upward trajectory. And like I say, I can't underestimate really or stress enough the importance of Sunday night against Melbourne City. If they can win that game, they keep they keep their top four hopes alive. And a home game in the playoffs, given the fact that Wellington have won six of their last seven at Westpac Stadium, would be a huge boost for this team. So let's hope that they can put all this behind them and put in a really good showing over the next couple of games.
And Jason, with all of this in mind, obviously, you know, the club is also thinking about the next step, life after Mark Rudin. Do you know who might be the best fit to come in and take over of what Mark Rudin has already achieved in the short space of time?
Oh, another great question, Louise. Yeah, and already that speculation, of course, has started as soon as, in fact, before the news was official. We were already thinking about who might be next once it became apparent that Mark Rudin was unlikely to stay. A lot of names have been thrown around, and I'm sure you've heard the same ones that I have. Warren Joyce is one who's been mentioned. I'm not sure what his situation is with Melbourne City. Marco Kurtz, I understand, he's also been mentioned, but I understand that Marco Kurtz has got an offer back in Europe, which he'll be taking up once he leaves Adelaide United. So I think he sort of comes off the table. I think they would be very, very wise not to go back to an unproven European coach, someone without A-League experience. I think that was Daria Kalasic's downfall. He just didn't have the knowledge of the A-League. If you look closer to home, there are actually very few candidates in New Zealand who have the necessary badges. You know, even the coach of the winning National League side, Eastern Suburbs, is Danny Hay, former All-White international and Premier League player with Leeds United. He doesn't have the necessary coaching badges. I spoke to Danny Hay yesterday and he confirmed to me that he doesn't have the badges that are needed. You know, working towards them, obviously, but wouldn't be able to come in. Just in the last little while, there's been talk of Des Buckingham returning to the job. He, of course, took interim charge when Ernie Merrick left midway through a season. Des is the coach of the under-20 New Zealand side that are about to head off to the World Cup in Poland. He was in Wellington today. Actually caught up with Des Buckingham today for a chat. He's another one. Chris Greenacre has been the go-to caretaker coach every time a coach has left Wellington. Or it might be somebody completely different, somebody who we haven't heard of. And if Mark Rudin's proven anything, it's that, you know, the step from state league up to A league is achievable. If you come in with the right attitude and you have strong beliefs and conviction, that step is possible. And Mark Rudin has proven that. So maybe there's somebody floating around state league in New South Wales, Queensland, or further afield who might fit the bill. But we all know it's going to be somebody. We just don't know at the moment who it's going to be.
What's Anthony Hudson up to these days? I think he's in America, right? Could he be?
Yeah, Colorado Rapids. He's not having great success over there with the Colorado Rapids. Unfortunately, he's had a couple of pretty barren, well, a season and a half of pretty barren results. Unfortunately, I'm not sure that he would be the right fit, to be honest with you, Josh. Like I say, he doesn't have that knowledge of the A-League. Mm. While he coached the New Zealand side, I just think that there might be a few gaps in his understanding of the way the A-League operates. And I'm not sure that he would be on a list of potential successors.
Well, Piney, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for coming on. We always enjoy chatting to you. And fingers crossed for the Phoenix when they visit Melbourne City this weekend.
Yeah, absolutely looking forward to it. And I just want to also just pass on my congratulations to Perth Glory. I've got to know Tony Pinata a little bit over the years and was delighted and not at all surprised to see him part of the success over there. Tony Sage, Tony Popovich, Jacob Burns and the entire playing group. I was delighted for Perth Glory to see them lift the Premier's plate. And who knows, guys, a distance derby grand final. Wouldn't be the most outrageous suggestion you've ever heard, I'm sure.
No, because I suggested that the other day.
Love it, Louise. Good stuff.
All right. Thanks for that, Jason. We'll talk to you soon.
Cheers, guys. See ya.
Jason Pine from Sky Sports New Zealand joining us there. Always fun to chat to Piney. And It's going to be a period of uncertainty for the Phoenix. It was interesting to see them drop Sarpreet Singh for their last game. I'm not sure what that was about. I think Redan said it was on for his form, but I think he should probably come straight back in for this weekend. And hopefully the players can get their heads right, because as Piney revealed there, he believes, as his sources are close to him, say that the players were told just before the Adelaide game, and that's when the performances went down the tubes.
That's exactly right, and that's why I asked him the question, how will this affect the team? Heading into the finals, they've been very consistent throughout the whole season. To now have a bit of a dip in form isn't a good sign on the cusp of finals. So let's hope and pray for them that they can turn it around this weekend in their second last game of regular season before the final series. But big news coming from that interview, Piney saying that Marco Kurz will take up an offer overseas in Europe. So
yeah,
in my eyes, he would have been one of the best candidates to 100%. Take over from Mark Rudin. So now that that potentially isn't on the table, it's really interesting to see who will be able to fit into that role and take over the success from Mark Rudin.
If I was a Phoenix fan, I'd be rocking back and forth in my chair saying, not Warren Joyce, not Warren Joyce.
But will he take the job or not? If I was Warren Joyce, I would go back to Manchester United. I'd want to be part of that revolution over there.
Yeah, 100%. That's what I would want to do as well. But he seems to have branched out to try and form a career for himself as a head coach. And if he can't do that over in the UK, then he might have to do it here. I just think it would be such a bad judgment call to bring Joyce in, because his style is so diametrically opposed to that of Redan. They need to bring a coach in who knows how to play fast-paced, counter-attacking football. And I think there are a number of coaches in the NPL who may suit that philosophy. I'm thinking about names like Scott Miller, who has had A-League experience and is doing wonders with Lang Warren at the moment, actually plays a very similar system to Redan. He tends to have a 3-4-2-1 instead of a 3-4-1-2 that Wellington Phoenix play over at Lang Warren. But his style of football is very much similar, high pressing, fast counterattacks. That's the style he's employed anyway at Lang Warren. I think he would be an excellent appointment, given that, you know, he's had some soul searching after he was probably given the Newcastle Jets job a little bit too early and has admitted that himself. But he, I think, is ready now and he's matured a lot as a coach. And if another, whether he'd leave Lang Warren at, you know, so early in the piece, I'm not sure. But if another A-League offer came up, I think it would be difficult for him to refuse.
It'd be interesting to see where he's at in his mind and within his own coaching career. He might want to stay at Lang Warren and, you know, take them to some success. But it's true what you say. He has had the experience, especially after being assistant coach at Fulham. So that's quite invaluable. And he does come with, you know, a certain style of play that would fit Wellington Phoenix. I think he would be a great fit. Whether or not he would take the job is another question.
I think there are a number of other names as well. If you look around the country, Abbasad has done very well with the Olympic. Luke Wilkshire at the moment, I think, is a bit early for him, but he's doing great things with Wollongong Wolves. Look up in Queensland, you've got Warren Moon and Ben Kahn, who are two very experienced coaches who haven't been given an opportunity just yet. And if the Brisbane Roar are going to pursue those two guys and go for someone like Robbie Fowler, an unproven foreign coach, just like Dario Kalajic was, then I think that Wellington Phoenix could do worse than examine some of those guys in NPL, because they've brought Mark Redan in from NPL and he's done wonders for the club. So if they can find a coach with a similar winning mentality and, you know, similar ideas about football to build on what he's achieved, I think that would be ideal.
Speaking of coaches, I caught up with one yesterday, and it was great to hear from him, because as we've discussed so many times on this program, it's great to see our Australian coaches move abroad, and there's only a small minority of them, but I did manage to catch up with Pex Wallers, Michael Valkanis, and we were talking a lot about how he thinks that there are a number of very, very good Australian coaches who should pursue overseas opportunities. And we talk a lot about Australian players moving abroad and moving overseas to forge out a career. How tough, though, is it for an Australian coach to move abroad and try and forge a career? Because we don't really see too many Australian coaches at the moment overseas. I think there's only yourself, Ange Postecoglou, Joe Montemurro, Harry Kewell, who's currently out of a job, Arthur Pappas, and maybe one or two others off the top of my head. But it is, as I said at the start of the interview, great to see that there are slowly more and more trying to make their way in Europe.
Yeah, look, it's difficult. It's difficult because there's no doubt about it. They look at you a bit funny when you turn up because you are coming from Australia. We're on the other side of the world. And I think, I really think they think of us as, what do they know on that side of the world? You know, they've got great beaches. They've got good weather. They like a barbecue. They like having a beer. What would they know more than us? And it's true. They look at us a little bit like that. And then you come along here and you start to work, and they've got really good coaches. There's no doubt about it. And they're tactically really savvy, and they do things really well. And we can learn from them as well. But once they do give us the opportunity to work, I think, and being a coach that's come here now and done that, you really realise that we're not far behind. We have got really good coaches as well. And that's one other thing. I think sometimes in Australia, we put our players down or we put our coaches down as well, that we generally like to think that we're not good enough, and because we're so far away from Europe. No, I think a lot of times, whether we're coaches or players, we're born in the country on the other side of the world, that far away from football, that we don't have the opportunities these guys have here. It doesn't mean that we're not good enough. I think they're good enough. And you'll generally see that Australian coaches work really hard away from home, and they study meticulously to become better, and they watch a lot of football to become better, and they try to evolve as coaches. We're here, they do get a little bit of their comfort zone, and it's funny that, you know, you come across and you're doing a job, and now you've been asked to coach their coaches. It's you know, I smile at it, but I feel good about it as well, that, you know what, we Australians can do a really good job over here, and it's just about being given an opportunity. And I think that you'll find that there's a lot of good Australian coaches in Australia. All they need is an opportunity, and it's hard to get by. And that's one of the things now in my mind as well, where, you know, it's you get opportunities to go here and there. But once you're in Europe, do you really want to give that away? Because it's such a hard place to break through as an Aussie. So, look, I'm looking to make the most of it, and I'm taking some side steps in where I want to be and what I want to do. And, you know, I love being in senior football and being in a senior environment, but also I'm pretty sure in what I'm doing now, it's given me skill sets that will make me a better head coach one day. There's no doubt about it, with the type of people I'm dealing with and what I've got to give over as well, and the work we're doing. It's fantastic. So going back to what you said, yeah, I think, you know, Australian coaches just need to be given an opportunity, because they're we're certainly good enough to be working abroad in Europe.
Yes, you're listening to Evenings on FNR. That was some of the interview that I was doing with Michael Valkanis last night. And head to FNR's SoundCloud or website. The full interview will be up on there. It's really interesting to hear what he's got to say, because he is over in the Netherlands there working under former Manchester United defender Jaap Stam. And that is invaluable. I mean, to have some Australian coaches working alongside experienced talent like that, you just really can't get any better right now. And just going by what he was saying, he says that he recognises that there are a lot of Australian coaches in the country that could do the same thing.
Yeah, and I applaud him for going overseas and trying something a bit different, because working in an Eredivisie club, I mean, Pex Zwolle, they have an impeccable youth development record, and now he's advising a lot of the youth coaches. So that shows that, you know, they respect the experience that he brings. It doesn't matter about nationality and background if you know your stuff. And he's worked with young players for quite some time, and he's in basically a youth technical director's role, it sounds like. I know you went into some of the, you know, would have gone into some of the specifics about what he's doing on a day-to-day basis in at Pex Zwolle, and it looked grim for him once Van Skip was sacked, but, you know,
he was asked to stay on.
Yeah, and that's fantastic. A lot of the time, the new coach, it's Jaap Stam, am I correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Coming in, will want to bring in an entire backroom staff of his own people, but he's kept most of the structures in place, and that's great news for Valkanis, and probably pretty good news for Danny Genro as well.
And I hear that Yap likes Denny Jonro and has given him a lot of great tips. And he actually let him go a week early when he was called into Oli Roux's camp. So, again, you can see how much Stam really values youth football and bringing through the young players. So it's a great philosophy that they do have over there. And even more delightful to see, as I said, more Australian coaches making their way in Europe, because we don't really have many. There's only really Ange Postecoglou, Arthur Pappas, as we've already spoken about off air, Harry Kuehl, who's not currently in a contract.
Yeah, Joe Montemurro, I guess, is the shining example overseas.
On the verge of some big success.
And that's really, I'm sure there's a few dotted here and there in lower leagues, but those are the most high-profile examples apart from Valkanis. So it would be great to see a lot of coaches take up the opportunities that are abroad to further themselves, because I think you get caught up in this little A-League bubble and the thinking is a little bit cookie cutter. A lot of the teams play quite similarly to each other, and if you go to an different environment where things are done differently, I think you'd expand your horizons. And I know Ange Postecoglou's time abroad, you know, before he became Socceroos manager, would have opened his eyes as well. And he's talked about that. I think Kevin Muscat might be the next one to go overseas.
Which league would be best suited to Kevin Muscat?
He's played in England and Scotland, but not necessarily. It doesn't have to be there. It all depends on where the opportunity is. Somewhere in continental Europe. I don't know what his language skills are like, but I think he's Maltese background, but you probably wouldn't want to go to Malta. Maybe too small a pond for him. But I think, especially considering he's been in charge of Victory for so long, I think everyone needs a break. He needs to maybe try something a bit different to further himself. And I think the club could use a fresh pair of hands on the steering wheel. Not that Muscat hasn't been successful. It seems to have just gone a little bit stale. So I think that would work for all parties, especially if Victoria were able to, you know, bring a really good replacement in.
Well, it's always that question as to not if, but when. When would Kevin Muscat make the jump abroad to coach?
I think at the end of this season might be a window. I mean, I was speaking about a month ago on For Vuck's Sake to one of the AAP journos, Benny Mackay, and he suggested, it was a rumour, and, you know, not based on hard evidence, but he suggested that he thought Muscat would leave at the end of the season, and the guy to take up the Victory job might be Ante Milicic, who's only caretaker coach of the Matildas. I don't know if he sees himself as a long-term Matildas coach. He certainly acquitted himself well in the short term, but if Victory were able to secure him, I think he's a much different style of coach to Kevin Muscat, and he plays a different style of football, and I think that, you know, would help Victory evolve.
And I think that Ante Milicic would love to return to club football.
I think so too. I think unless it's the club coming in a year later, Southwest Sydney MacArthur, who have been linked with him pretty strongly, I think he'll have offers for sure, especially considering how well he started his Matildas regime.
And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens if Kevin Muscat does leave at the end of the season. I think we should ask one of our very good friends. It's time for the journos with the Herald Sun's Dave Davutovic. Dave, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolute pleasure, and just apologise in advance because I've got the little man with me and he might make some noise in the background. So I might add a bit of colour to this little interview.
Fantastic. I always love a new contributor on FNR. So, you know, maybe we need a graphic for him on the socials as well. But Dave,
yeah, I'll send you his CV soon, guys.
All right. Yeah, we'll go over it. We've got to go through the same process. Can't be any, nepotism or favours just because you're
right.
Mate. But I want to start with Alex Brosk retiring from A-League football. One of the few players left from the very start of the A-League in 2005, a bona fide Sydney FC legend, and I think he leaves a big hole, even though he has come off the bench a lot this season.
Yeah, well, funnily enough, I was just looking back at some NSL records and won the under 21 player of the year, I think, a couple of times with Marconi. I mean, he's been around for, I think it was about 99 or 2000. He made his debut, was dubbed the next Harry Kuehl, and, you know, had immense talent. And look, he's had a fantastic career. Unfortunately, he's not the only one who's been dubbed with the, the next Kuehl moniker. And there were a few next Padukas, weren't there, who, didn't quite live up to the billing. But, you know, when you get sort of tagged with something like that, it's obviously comes with mass expectation. But when you look at his career in isolation, he's had a fantastic career, Alex Brosk. And especially when you consider, it was probably, two or three years ago, where he had that succession of hamstring injuries. And there was that one where he pulled up lame, you know, stepping up to take a penalty. And you just think, gee, he must be absolutely cooked if he's pinging a hammy, taking a pen. So, you know, for him to eke out another couple of years and to play at the, you know, high calibre that he has done, starting most games, occasionally, you know, coming off the bench in a fantastic Sydney FC side, you know, absolute credit to him. And, you know, I think it adds a really interesting dimension to the final series because, you know, this time last week or, you know, late last week, Carl Vallery announced his retirement, and I think it was really important for victory in that week coming off that Asian Champions League battering. I thought it gave him a lift, and I suspect that it might give him a lift for the rest of the season, but it's certainly evened out now off the back of Alex Brost's announcement. I mean, he's been at Sydney FC even longer than, you know, what Vallery's been at victory, although in saying that, I think, you know, Vallery's contribution over that four-year period has been immense. So I think it'll be very even in terms of the, you know, the motivating effect it'll have on their teammates.
And Dave, when do you think it's appropriate to retire a player's number? In this case, would it be appropriate to retire Alex Brosk's number?
Oh, look, yeah, probably not. I don't think he's necessarily, you know, to retire a player's number, you know, it's got to be pretty significant. And not taking nothing away from Brosk's contribution to Sydney FC. But like I said, I mean, he started in you know, 2000. The A-League only started in 2005. So I guess, you know, perhaps if Sydney FC were around back then or, you know, whatever it may be, different story. But, you know, he did start with Queensland Roar, as they were called, in the early days of the A-League. You know, but I guess, you know, he's pretty bloody close. But yeah, you look at someone like West Ham, I guess, and they've got two shirt numbers retired. Sir Bobby Moore, the World Cup winning captain of 1966 and club great. And then, you know, Dylan Tombides, who, the young Aussie, who obviously passed away in tragic circumstances in 2014. So, yeah, look, not quite, but, yeah, good discussion point.
And I think there's a massive what-if with Alex Brosk's career because it seemed like injuries really affected kind of his ceiling. And there was a moment there, maybe was it 2012, when he was scoring goals against Saudi Arabia for the Socceroos, and it seemed like he might be the next striker for the national team.
Yeah, I remember that game at Melbourne Rectangular Stadium, as they like calling it in Asia. you know, I think Harry Kewell was playing in that game, and Archie Thompson and Brett Emerton, and you know, they're all back in the A-League then. And, yeah, you know, he's a very good player who, you know, certainly didn't look out of place when elevated to the Socceroos setup and, you know, playing alongside, you know, the Kills and these sorts of guys. Really intelligent turn of speed. I just think maybe with him, he maybe lacked that sort of belief to really go on to the next level. You know, maybe that sort of NSL to A-League transition, that 18-month buffer potentially hurt him as well. Although, you know, he did go overseas. I think he went to Belgium and played some football over there. But, yeah, he's such a nice guy, Brosky. He looks like in the last few years he's developed that real, I guess, hard edge. And maybe just with that maturity and whatnot has, you know, it's coincided with that additional self-belief. But certainly had the tools to, you know, I think really go and play over in Europe and have a good career over there. But again, that's taking nothing away from his illustrious career because there's been some fantastic players who chose not to play overseas. You know, going back to the NSL days, Paul Trimboli, Damien Murray, you know, and obviously a few more guys in the A-League era with the extra funds that have come into the professional game locally.
And Dave, I did want to ask you, just moving on to, there's been a lot of talk about the National Second Division in recent weeks. You wrote a piece in the Herald Sun, I think towards the end of the last week, you know, arguing about the importance of it. What do you make of the way this whole thing is shaping up and the pretty ambitious start date of 2020 or 2021?
Yeah, well, firstly, I'm just eagerly awaiting the release of the FFA's white paper. Mm. Unless it's been released in the last couple of hours, I don't think it's been sent out yet. There was talk that it was going to be released even as early as 2 weeks ago. So, you know, a lot of the discussion has been, you know, John Didlitz of the Players Union Chief did a series of interviews, I think a couple of weeks ago, where he declared that it has to be a professional second division and, you know, promotion relegation, you know, can only really kick in when there's basically a, you know, there's 2018. So, in other words, a commercially viable second division. And then there's been some stuff come out today. I think Archie Fraser was quoted, who's been heavily involved with the AAFC, the NPL Clubs Umbrella Group. And, you know, I think initially their position was a semi-professional second tier. And I know there's going to be a lot of clubs put their hand up for the second division. Seen a few mixed responses, because initially I heard that there were four or five NPL clubs that were going to put their hand up to be professional in the second division. But I spoke to Gary Marocchi last week from Perth, and he was they were one of the clubs that were sort of mentioned, and he denied that that was the case. So it's going to be interesting how this plays out. I think, yeah, obviously, like I said, we've heard from the various stakeholders, but the key is going to be this FFA white paper, because Remo Nogarotto has chaired this, you know, second division working group. So I think that will ultimately give us the greatest idea in terms of how this will proceed. But look, it's inevitable. It's a case of timing. I can't see any reason why. What are we now? April 2019. If we get cracking, I can't see why this second division couldn't start in 2020, because I just sort of, you know, look back at the expansion process that was just run. And speaking to, you know, people from the various, you know, groups, you know, from Canberra, the Canberra bid to, you know, to Team 11, to South Melbourne, to, Tasmania, they were knocked out a fair bit earlier. But all of these people want to go again. And, you know, some of them have even made announcements since, I think it was Team 11, wasn't it, last week, announcing that, you know, their investors want to go, and they've just given my old mate Matty Winley a one-year contract extension, you know, which indicates that they are serious to be, you know, wanting to be a part of a professional second division, obviously, if not the A-League. But, you know, from what I gather, no one has really got any solid direction from the FFA, or any other, you know, stakeholder for that matter, really needs to come from the FFA at the moment. So there's a real want and desire from people to move forward, just waiting on some clarity. So, yeah, I guess we'll eagerly await the release of this white paper and move from there. But, you know, certainly when you look at all the stuff that's going on at A-League level, you know, obviously I've had discussions in the last couple of days, but, you know, the ratings aren't great, and you know, the A-League is on the nose in many ways. And I'm not, you know, by any stretch predicting, you know, the death of the A-League or anything like that. I think the A-League will be here for forever and a day. And, you know, I think we're just paying for some indecision over the last 3 or 4 years. But in light of, you know, the numbers and the figures, I just think there's a real appetite to expand, and that includes the second division. And I think there's a place for it in the game. And I think it will actually enhance the A-League as opposed to, you know, cannibalise, especially if you start opening up transfer systems and loan systems and, you know, making sure they effectively work in together, you know, whether that's playing on separate days or whatever that may be. But, yeah, it just needs to happen.
I think so too, Dave. I'm not sure about the finances and the logistics of it, but given there were so many expansion
bids...
Well,
mate, the game... Sorry to cut you off.
Yeah, go for it.
The game just knocked back $100 million.
Yeah.
So, you know, anyone that tells me we can't afford it, I mean, fair dinkum. The FFA turns over 150 mil, and little Nicky absolutely agrees by the sounds of things in the background. He's calling for expansion and a second division. You know, like, right, with the FFA's turned over, I'm not sure what the latest, you know, turnover is, but certainly for a few years, it's been around that 115 million mark. I mean, the game effectively knocked back $100 million of expansion money from local investors and overseas investors. So, I mean, mate, I'm no financial guru, but I reckon, you know, obviously even at a second division, the licence fee would be at a lesser rate. But even if it's $1 or $2 or $3 million, if you've got 10 teams coming in paying a licence fee of $2 million, mate, that's $20 million to play with. I reckon that's enough to run a competition.
That was exactly what I was going to say, Dave. I mean, the game would be foolish to knock back all that capital if they're still ready to go, these expansion teams. And then it presents the opportunity, also the complication of maybe ingrating the former NSL giants, such as South Melbourne and Melbourne Knights and Sydney Olympics and so on and so forth, who... I don't know if they're ready to go professional. Maybe this thing has to be semi-pro to be practical, but I think any second division is better than nothing, to be honest, whether it's professional or not. I know the PFA is going to have their concerns, and they are the Professional Footballers Association, so you would be expecting them to advocate for the best contracts and player conditions they can. But, you know, if that's the way you have to make it work, I think it's a necessity.
Yeah, I mean, when I look at the, you know, the local NPL competitions, which are going really well, I don't necessarily think a national... semi-professional second division will be all that much more appealing for, you know, for some of these clubs. A professional one, absolutely. But, you know, there's some great local derbies that, you know, that take place and all that. So, you know, to add to triple or quadruple cost, possibly even more, for a national competition that's ultimately going to be part-time and ain't going to benefit, you know, Australia's national teams and particularly youth national teams, I don't really see the benefits of that. I think the second division absolutely needs to be professional, and it can be professional. But I think what needs to happen is we need to take a medium to long-term view of things. You know, just over in Japan, and, you know, they had a 100-year plan, right? And, you know, the part of the plan is to have 100 professional clubs, and now they're up to, what is it, 58, three divisions. So, you know, all right, maybe not 100 years, but let's look at a 20-year plan. And there was a whole of football plan and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, let's not waste too much time on that, because it realistically wasn't worth the paper it was written on. But, you know, if you start looking at, you know, in 10 or 15 years' time, I don't think there's any reason why we shouldn't have a, you know, shouldn't look at having a national, you know, professional third division, or, you know, a bit of both, like the J-League, where most of the clubs are or have professional elements, you know, to it. So once you start looking medium to long term and you reverse engineer it, there's a spot for everyone in the professional game. The old NFL clubs, some of the new franchises that want to be a part of it, perhaps that, you know, aren't represented or haven't been represented historically. But, you know, let's start being bold and strategic and growing, because, yeah, I mean, you can't even compare it to AFL and NRL, who, you know, the NRL is getting really cold feet about expanding. The AFL has expanded fairly aggressively, but, you know, they're different sports, and, you know, football is international. There's so many international businesses and investors that want to get involved in the game and want to invest for various reasons. So, yeah, let's give them the opportunity. But, you know, when you look at the national youth teams, and speaking to Graham Arnold, I mean, like, it just, you know, the second division for mine has to be professional, because a national part-time second division ain't going to help the Ollieroos or the Young Socceroos. I mean, I don't think there will be that much of an uplift in quality, you know, for the national team coaches, for instance, to then come and, you know, recruit players from there. A national professional second division, you know, different story. And all of a sudden, I think that can, you know, provide the nucleus of the players, certainly at, you know, Joey's and Young Socceroos level, you know, and potentially even Ollieroos level. You look at that squad that played in the qualifiers for Arnie, what, last month. Only five or six of those players are regulars in their A-League teams. Mm. You know, so for Fani to actually get through to the next phase of qualifying, hats off to him. But, like, Young Socceroos, you go, fair enough. But for the Ollieroos to have basically only a quarter of the team playing regularly in the A-League, or, you know, overseas for that matter, I think that gives you a fair idea of where we're at. So I'm really strong on the fact that we need to, you know, expand professional opportunity. Especially if, you know, the talk of seven visa players in the A-League, you know, eventuates, I think that would be disastrous for the development of Australian players. And that was the ultimate crux of the article last week. I think, you know, all decisions now, I mean, it was sort of the headline, and that was talking about the second division. But, you know, ultimately, all decisions, be it second division, A-League, you know, international windows, whatever, I think all the decisions really need to be made thinking about the development of, you know, Australian players and particularly young Australian players.
Completely agree with you, Dave. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. We'll have to leave it
there.
Yeah,
sorry, guys. I went on a bit of a rant. But,
that's fantastic. Yeah. Love it.
Thanks, Josh. Appreciate it.
We will speak to you again at the same time next week. But you have a great weekend. And yeah, looking forward to continuing that discussion.
Yep, absolutely. All the best, guys.
That was the Herald Sun's Dave Davutovic joining us there. Josh, we have completely run out of time.
We could talk about promotion and relegation all night.
And youth football. You know how long I could go on about that. But unfortunately, we can't. We'll have to save that till tomorrow. Bye for now.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.